I want to pick up on what you talked about Jem.
Which one are we talking about?
We're talking about Michael Moe when he ran clip from Gilligan's Isle.
Everybody knew
the three-hour tour.
Yeah.
And nobody knew the next question.
What's the quadratic equation?
Yeah. Although there were a few. They yelled out. They did get it right. But there weren't very many.
There weren't very many. And I think that leads to the point of education.
So I heard somebody talk about Gilligan's Island as a model for a company. You know, you need to have the scientist. You need to have the leader, skipper. You need to have the kind of jokester, Gilligan. And, you know, you go through it. You need to have the patrician, the man and lady that were, you know, rich from Texas. And I was sitting there thinking, oh, that's really interesting. Gilligan's Island is a metaphor for how you run a company.
I love it.
Sorry, that wasn't what you were talking about.
No, but it plays to actually what I am talking about, which is we're hearing an awful lot more about education having to be entertaining as a way of grasping, keeping the information. You see an awful lot of companies. Is that playing out in what people present?
I think that's true of everything. I think government needs to be entertaining. I think education needs to be entertaining. I think banking needs to be entertaining. I think entertaining is not a weird concept that's only known by Hollywood, you know, that makes movies and has celebrity actors. Entertaining is something that people want in their daily lives. So, yeah, you don't want to go to a classroom and get bored. It's not kind of the point. But entertaining doesn't just mean flash and, you know, and cinema. It means intellectually engaging and relevant, contextually accurate, and all that, those big words that people use. So I believe that's true, but I don't say it's just education.
As you look at the education space from a VC point of view, what are you seeing that's interesting?
How long do we have? Because you're talking about one of the fundamental activities that we engage in, educating ourselves. And I referred to government and banking. And what's so amazing about the time that we're involved in here, we're all old people, and we remember back when it was the personal computer before the, and you know, local area networks and all of the things that we went through. That was not totally relevant in all walks of life. But now the internet's happened in the past 20 plus years. The internet's creeped into everything and is changing everything. So the way I got to the hotel this morning was to call an Uber X and not a taxi. And I use my phone and I don't pick it up and cradle it in my shoulder. And I, you know, I don't have an IBM Selectric typewriter. Everything has changed and it's going into the institutions that we have. And so the reason I'm here, because education is a fundamental institution, as people keep talking about, and fundamental to the American dream, which is what Michael talks about. But it's true in government and in every other institution that we depend on, and in every other country, even if the institutions are different, they're all being changed by this change in technology and fundamentals. So what I find interesting here is we're talking about really basic stuff about our country. You know, it is themed around the American dream, so it is focused on our country, and there is acknowledgement that we're educational systems in deep trouble and not being very effective, and we're sitting around talking about stuff they must have been sitting around talking about when the country was formed 200 plus years ago. We could be like George Washington and talking about, or whoever it is, and talking about, you know, how do you organize things in an environment like this. And what I love is my Michael Moe, and really actually Michael Crow this morning, was basically saying, toss our old institutions and here's how to build a whole new system. And he's the president of a major university, a major state university, and a real thinker about this stuff. And I think that was pretty, he was basically saying, well, screw that old stuff, just do what we're doing, throw out everything.
There's been also running through this, the conference so far, this whole concept of making education available to everybody. And when we talk about everybody, we mean everybody. Mm-hmm. We mean the kids who perhaps came here when they were 18 months old. It was not their fault that their parents came here illegally, but they have a right to education. It strikes me as strange still, as a European transplanted to the US 25 years ago or more, that we live in a country, our nation is a country where the two fundamentals of a European country and many other countries are education and healthcare. They are part of what a country gives its people. Everybody gets it, and we don't.
Gee, that's a very European point of view. It is not true that every government gives it, and we don't. It's not a right. It's a privilege. So I don't know, we could have a long political conversation about that, but the starting point is not that governments give it to you. And then governments in Europe, are only one has really figured out how to give it to you and still be solvent, and that's Sweden. Sweden has a remarkable system that really should be studied by anybody, but it's the Swedes. How relevant are the Swedish people? Oh, they got some pretty good murder mysteries. You know, they have excellent looking women. They're, you know, they make some good food, maybe. It depends on your taste. I'm just joking, but yeah. The point is that's you just made a presumption that I think was flawed.
I have never minded being told I'm wrong.
You still have an accent too, so you give yourself away.
I have to work on that because I was with the BBC for so long. But I mean, why is healthcare a privilege? We are going off on a tangent, but why is healthcare?
Yeah, and education is a privilege too. And so, if you want to have a great society where people have health and are educated, you have to deal with their underlying motivations to want to be that way. I went to a session with a guy from the World Bank this morning that was really interesting, and World Bank says that 1.2 billion people live on less than a dollar and a quarter a day, and he was talking about how you go to Starbucks and buy a frappuccino, and you just spent 3 days worth of income for 1 billion people. Health and education are not a right that everybody has. It's something that you earn by creating an economically viable system where you get everybody participating, and so the path to getting there is not by giving it to people. The path to getting there is by getting everybody involved and creating a system in which everybody has a role to play, and you have a truly involved, engaged population, which actually is exactly the principle that we were founded on. Right, which is life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, that universal education should be for all. The guys that came up with this concept, of course, had slaves, and you know there was imperfections in the system, but you know the fundamental idea was there, and that's why people get so motivated by the United States of America, is that we have these basic principles. Maybe we achieve it, maybe not, but we did not do it by shipping all the money to Washington, D.C., and then giving you what you should have a right to. That's not the way systems work. In fact, that looks a lot more like the old Soviet Union than it does the way that we do things. So the way that we do things has to be reinvented and brought up to date. And in fact, you talked about the Michael Moe presentation. I was really impressed with Jeb Bush talking about his, I wish I could remember all the different things. He has a grandchild who, or a great-grandchild who is, part Mexican, part Croatian. Or I can't remember all the, and he's really proud of it. You know, I have a grandchild. My daughter married a Muslim immigrant, so I have a grandson now who's 4 years old, who is being raised mostly by his mother, who is a communist, who is a public school teacher, and an anarchist, really, who married a Muslim immigrant. So I have this mixed race grandchild who's just a wonderful human being, and he will never have any sense of discrimination, or he's going to have a really clear sense now. He's going to be a little screwed up politically, and I'll have to try to straighten that out later when I can, but I'm really proud of that. And I thought Jeb Bush is standing up there, and he may run for president, and he's proud that he has a great grandchild who's a mixed race grandchild. And when he talked about universal access, he was really talking about universal access. We're going to educate everybody. Why do you get all screwed up on whether what color their skin is or what religion they have and all this kind of stuff? This is America. This is where people come. He appealed to my fundamental patriotism, which I believe very strongly that America represents something and has not been living up to the expectation that we should have for this country over the past couple of decades.
Well, I, covered his father's...
By the way, I couldn't agree with you more.
Agree with you more.
Yeah. More passionately. This is my dream.
Well, what the hell are we telling people not to come here for? Why do we make it hard for people to immigrate to this? This is what
totally
the country stood for right. Centuries.
It's been the wealth of the country.
Is the new ideas, the passion, we all know people who've come here from other countries, who came here came on boats, they crawled ashore.
My mom came from the UK, she's British. British woman.
She
did come on a boat, actually. It was on and her furniture was strapped to the deck of it, but it was during World War II, and she was worried about the boat being blown up by submarines. But
I mean, this couple came with nothing. They were refugees from Vietnam. They're proud that they've been able to buy a second car.
You never find anybody more patriotic than somebody who had to work their way into this country.
And they're sending their kids to college. They're working their fingers to the bone to send their kids to ASU. Yeah. But they're really proud of being here.
Yeah.
And to shut the door on these people is insane.
To shut the door, or not to even honor the effort they put in, and to celebrate that. I mean, immigration's been a political debate here over many decades, because then the get here want to close the door behind them. But that's not who we stand. That's
not who
we are.
I think it goes back more than a few many decades.
Well, you go back to the kind of the Depression and before that. But even in the 1800s, there weren't that many people here, so it was a little bit of less.
But every time there's been a
wave,
whenever there's been a big wave, then that wave
tries to shut the door.
On the ones that so you had the Italian immigration, the Irish, the Russians, then the Jews, then the this, the German. I mean,
now we're just doing it generically, and that's really disturbing.
That's a tragedy, isn't it?
It's not. We're, I'm about as white as you can get.
I think somebody made the interesting observation in the last election: the WASPiest of the four candidates, basically president, vice president, was a black guy.
I refer to Obama, and I'm daydreaming, stepping into the political cesspool here, but I call Obama the black Jimmy Carter. He's really smart. He's too smart for his own britches, and he overthinks everything, and he doesn't operate out of his gut. And that's why Ronald Reagan was so powerful, because, he was obviously not too smart for everybody, but he had a really simple point of view, and he was very consistent and stuck to his point of view and had a huge impact on the world because of that, partially because, he just outcompeted the Soviet Union, but also because, he insisted on a set of principles for running the economy and other issues.
Well, let's briefly then talk about education trends in education.
I'm a bomb thrower.
Okay.
I'm not a communist, and I'm not an anarchist, and I love the fact that my daughter is, but I'm a bomb thrower. And I look at systems, and I had a lot of experience. I had a particular experience when I started with another person, the Foundation for Educational Software, and say 1990, I can't remember exactly when we did it, but in the early 90s. We got to know the educational system at the time, and the educational system is composed of a set of communities of interest, each of whom are completely focused on their own interest. The teachers, the parents, administrators, the legislators, and you run through all those communities of interest. There was really no fundamental interest in the point of education, in particular in public education, which was actually a right that the Constitution does devolve on people in America. And so I became profoundly disillusioned that the educational system could ever be fixed. This is more than 20 years ago. So I spent the last couple of decades being disillusioned and really not caring, because it didn't seem to me that anything would ever be fixed. And, even if you had presidents come along that called themselves the education president, which was Bush, and then Obama came along, and I just don't see any fundamental change. It's great that we have Jim Shelton talking tonight. That's a change, actually. Having a guy like that in the Department of Education is good. But the federal government shouldn't be solving this problem. This is truly a local problem. It's one of the things that Jeb Bush said last night that I thought was really, really important. Schools should be local. Parents are local, and buildings are local, and the teachers are local. Everything should be done locally, not by the federal government and not by the state government. And that is where our educational system came from. So I don't see any path forward from where we are to a better system. And so it's my belief that the real path forward is to throw that system out completely and replace it with something else. I think that's going to begin in the higher education, because it is more voluntary, it's less required. And so people will choose the path that leads them to most success. It's much harder in the K-12 system, because it is publicly funded and it is this huge bureaucracy. It's much harder. But you still see the growth of homeschooling and the growth of charter schools, and people are really seeking alternatives to make sure that their kids actually grow up functional human beings, which was the whole point of public education in the first place, is that you have a literate population that can read and write and evaluate issues and vote intelligently and participate in the public domain. But now we have a system that produces 30% of the people can't even write. How are they going to learn how to vote?
Less than 30% vote.
Yeah, and we also have a system that doesn't people aren't motivated to participate in.
How do you have a country with 30% that are illiterate and 80% of the jobs require college education?
Yeah, I mean, these are all obvious questions, but people have been asking them for decades. I mean, I've heard these questions over and over and over again for decades. It's like that nothing's actually happened. Nobody in the government's going to change it, and nobody seems to have a vision for it. The only way it's going to happen is through some kind of bottoms-up grassroots organization, that grassroots effort that comes because technology enables it, just like an Uber shows up, or the Airbnb or whatever, that challenges all the old rules.
So your view is that the change will actually come from the colleges rather than sort of the charter schools, homeschooling, people trying to bypass the system.
Bypass the system and remove the underpinnings for the system. I'm a big believer in radical change, because there's no benefit to people in changing incrementally. It's scary and against their own interests. So the only way you really get that is, and this is a country founded out of radical change, picked up guns and started shooting and you know, not sure that we're going to have a revolution here. It's kind of a comfortable place to live.
So where does Common Core fit into this whole equation?
Well, I kind of appreciate Common Core because it is the definition of a basic set of things that you need to learn and demonstrate that you learn. The problem is it's getting interpreted differently in every state, so it's not really a Common Core. My daughter is a school teacher. She's a fifth grade school teacher in the San Francisco Public Unified School District, and she complains about this very thing. That so it's being rammed down the throats of teachers by the state legislature. Doesn't necessarily support the fundamental idea of Common Core. And she has, you know, a majority of, she's in a Spanish immersion school where part of the reason she's a teacher there is she's fluent in Spanish and fluent in English, and so she teaches in both languages to a population of kids that are at least 20% can't really speak English, only speak Spanish, and which is a huge problem in public school districts is the language problem. So she looks at the Common Core and what she gets told to teach and finds that it's largely irrelevant to a Hispanic-speaking kid whose parents are both working, and so she chooses to do whatever she wants to do in order to make sure that her kids get taught something that's useful and enable them. Well, you got to have a Common Core system that allows people to make those kind of local decisions. It goes back to being local.
I mean, the whole fundamental thing was precisely to avoid federal government and divide it. And when you look back at the...
Look at where the money comes from. Yeah. It used to be that all the money for public financing came from property taxes. In other words, it was funded locally. So you pay your property taxes, you get a school that's paid for by those property taxes. Now the system is property taxes only pay about 15 or 20% of the cost of public education, and like 60 or 70% comes from the state, and the balance comes from federal and other sources. People seem to think that would be a good idea if the federal government was paying the whole bill. Look at our healthcare system. That's going to be that's another disaster. So having the federal government pay for this stuff in our country just doesn't work. And Sweden, it's fine. You know, it kind of worked out the balance.
Smaller as well. I mean, the
but smaller, and you know, people are kind of more, you know, you don't have a lot of innovative companies coming out of Sweden. You really want an entrepreneurial environment where you've got people making a, you know, right now there's this idea that there you can make too much money. Who gets to decide who's how much is too much? You know, there's Larry Ellison too rich. I mean, he's kind of a jerk. And but is he too rich? I mean, what's the definition of too rich? Should football players not be paid $20 million? Or, you know, it's like, okay, you know, it's like this is a free enterprise system. It's kind of the way it works. It's nobody gets to say. And God, Jeb Bush is talking about a level playing field. The government's job is to make sure that the field is playing level. I mean, is level, and so everybody can play on it. It's not the job to determine outcomes. It's the job to play, you know, create the structure.
I thought that he was extraordinary. Yeah. I was terribly surprised that...
I tweeted that I'd vote for him. That was a pretty interesting... I tweet everything.
I think she would have said the same.
I think I would have said the same. Yeah. I mean, I certainly would have voted for his father over Clinton had I been able to vote. I would, after the speech last night, based on the speech last night, nothing else.
Yeah, plus what I've heard about him otherwise.
He's
exceeded himself out of being governor of Florida. And you know, his brother actually went through a similar experience. He was governor of Texas, very successful governor of Texas, and actually did a lot to change education in Texas. And, you know, some people think it didn't last, but at least when he was first elected, he was running on the record that he created as the governor of Texas, and Jeb is running on the record that he created as governor of Florida. But it looks to me like Jeb's got it screwed ahead on better.
Well, it's interesting, as I say, having covered George Herbert Walker Bush, which was a very interesting administration.
Very, very nice guy.
Very nice guy, surrounded by incredibly competent people.
Yeah.
I mean, Jim Baker is one of the best human beings I've ever spent time with. Absolutely.
Reagan had really good people, too. And it's the thing about...
He was a Baker guy, anyways. Baker was a Reagan guy, too.
And, you know, you got to say that Clinton had pretty good people around him too.
Well, I think Bush's problem was more that he had people like Cheney around him, and Cheney had changed, and I think he just got carried away. I don't think he had the strength to be able to and whatever it took to control these people.
He started out thinking, hire good people, because that's why he talked. He said, I'm not, you know, I was just reading the Gates book, you know, following Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense. It's like, ooh, that guy was a nut job.